Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Dublina Chakraborty.
And I'm Sarah Dowdy.
And the subject of royal pretenders is one that just really continues to fascinate and intrigue the both of us. In March, we covered Lambert Simnel, who was pretender to the English throne at the young age of 10. But here's the thing. While he and his supporters may have given Henry VII cause for concern, Simnel never actually became king. But for the royal pretender we're going to look at here, it was a really different story. Tsar Dmitry, who's commonly known as False Dmitry I, not only usurped the Russian throne in 1605, he also gained the widespread support of people across all classes in Russia while pretending to be the son of none other than Ivan the Terrible.
So he did it. He's not just a pretender. He really made it happen. But we're going to be calling him False Dmitry I. But just so we can avoid any confusion right off the bat, there were actually two other false Dmitrys who weren't quite as successful as this first one. And we're going to talk about both of them too. But first, before things get too complicated, we need to set up this story a little bit and talk about who the real Dmitry was, leaving those other three false guys out of the picture for the moment, and also try to figure out why somebody would try to pretend to be him in the first place.
Before we take a look at those questions, though, we've really got to take a look at 16th century Russia, or the end of the 16th century at least. As the 16th century was drawing to a close, the old dynasty of the Grand Princes of Moscow, or the Rurik dynasty, was coming to an end. Tsar Ivan, better known as Ivan the Terrible, died in 1584, and though he'd had a number of wives, countless lovers, and many, many children, he really didn't have that many options for an heir.
Partly his own fault, too.
Right. So this is what happened. Many of the legitimate children that he had turned out to be sickly, and they didn't survive Ivan. As for the illegitimate ones, it's said that Ivan would actually suffocate them with his own hands to make sure that there wasn't a power struggle after he died.
Ironically, a power struggle does still develop.
That's very true. There were two sons left after Ivan died, Fyodor and Dmitry. Fyodor was the older one, and he actually became Tsar after Ivan's death. He wasn't a very effective czar, though. Some sources suggest that he may have actually had some sort of mental disability, or at the very least was ill-suited to ruling a country.
So somebody else had to step in, his wife's brother, Boris Godunov, who basically governed for him. And before his death, Ivan even named Godunov as Fyodor's guardian. So it's the start of trouble, raising this man to a very high, very powerful position, because Godunov had a lot of power now, and it seemed like maybe he would be the next in line for the throne. And there was still that other son, though, so this is where things get complicated. Dmitry, Ivan's other legitimate child, but at this point he was just a little boy, so he didn't seem to be a real contender here as a successor to Fyodor.
Yeah, also, it might have been tough to prove Dmitry's legitimacy because he was the son of Ivan's seventh or maybe eighth wife, depending on what source you look at. And I think something like after the third wife, the kids weren't really considered legitimate, so that caused a problem anyway. But he still would have had a claim. So that's probably why Dmitry and his mother were exiled to Uglich after Ivan's death. But the boy died there in 1591, around age 8 or 10, and of course there are mysterious circumstances involved. It wouldn't be a good pretender story unless there were some mysterious circumstances here.
We're just a Russian royal childhood story. So some people said that the death was natural, although natural doesn't even really sound very good. He supposedly stabbed himself during an epileptic seizure.
Yeah, you have to wonder why an 8 to 10-year-old boy is holding a knife anyway.
Yeah, although that was my first question, and how he managed to stab himself with it. But there you go. That's the one potentially natural solution. However, though, there was also a rumor that it was Godunov who had had the child murdered, which seems kind of likely, too, this power-hungry guy who does step in after this kid is out of the way. But regardless of what the truth was here, Dmitry was now out of the picture. And since Fyodor had a wife and only one daughter, Feodosia, who died as an infant, this really left the door wide open for Godunov to step up and take the throne himself.
Yeah, and incidentally, some suspected Godunov of involvement in Feodosia's death, too, so we should mention that. But sure enough, after Fyodor's death in 1598, Godunov was elected to the throne by popular assembly, but Tsar Boris, as he's often known, didn't have an easy go of it at all.
We shouldn't make it seem entirely like he just came in there and claimed the throne for himself, too. He was elected to his position, but not everyone was a fan of the new Tsar Boris. In particular, the Boyars, who are basically old aristocratic families, upper nobility, they were specifically opposed to him. And out of all of these old families, the Romanovs especially really didn't like Tsar Boris. And part of that is because they thought they had a better claim to the throne. Tsar Fyodor's mother, Ivan the Terrible's first wife, Anastasia, had been a Romanov. So the family thought that through her and through their relation to the latest Tsar, they had a pretty good claim.
So Tsar Boris needed a way to deal with these rivals of his. And what he did is in 1600, he arrested all the Romanov brothers and sent them all out of Moscow. That wasn't the end of Tsar Boris's troubles, though, either. Soon other social classes weren't really happy with him, though some sources refer to Tsar Boris as an intelligent and capable ruler who did things like reforming the judicial system and sending students to be educated in Western Europe. He also had the misfortune of being on the throne during a terrible famine that lasted from about 1601 to 1603. The harvest failed all those summers, three successive summers, and Tsar Boris really didn't deal with this effectively at all. It hurt his reputation and destabilized his regime.
Yeah, so there was this idea floating around that Tsar Boris wasn't a true Tsar at all. These economic problems, these social conflicts that were all coming to a head, even the famine, it was all kind of his fault. And this, combined with Dmitry's premature death, opened the door for pretenders. So new guys could come in and the stage was set for some kind of revolution.
It was. And then in 1603, at the height of this crisis in Russia, a young man appeared in Poland, Lithuania, and presented himself to Prince Adam and other nobles there as the Tsarevich Dmitry, the youngest son of Ivan the Terrible and the true heir to the Russian throne.
Wait a minute.
I know. What's going on here?
He's supposed to be dead.
He's supposed to be dead. So here's how Dmitry explained himself. He told people that Godunov had sent hired assassins to kill him in Uglich back in 1591. So what was rumored to have happened did happen. Godunov had tried to have him killed, but his tutor had saved him, or so Dmitri claimed, by cleverly substituting another boy for Dmitri, and that boy was killed instead of him.
So sounds like a pretty interesting story. And according to an article in History Today by Maureen Perry, this new Dmitri, who did receive an audience with the Polish king in 1604, had some proof for all of these tall claims. For one, he was recognized, supposedly, by Russian exiles who claimed to have known the boy. You know, it's not too hard to believe there. Some people would have definitely been familiar with his face, might have been able to recognize him. But he also displayed so-called royal birthmarks. And
we're not quite sure what that means.
We were trying to figure out what that meant. What makes a royal birthmark?
Or I don't know. Is it especially large or like shaped like a crown?
Or is it just as simple as maybe they knew Dmitri had some specific birthmark and look, there it is.
Or maybe the family all had the same birthmark.
Something. Anyways, he has the royal birthmark, so he's good there. And then he also had a jeweled cross that was allegedly given to him by his godfather. So the Polish are sold on this, and they have pretty good reason to be sold after Dmitri even converted to Catholicism in Krakow. So now he's sort of entering their fold, and they're getting their new friend Dmitri, or hoping to get their new friend Dmitri, on the Russian throne, which offered some really exciting possibilities for the expansion of Poland's influence into Russia and the Vatican's reach as well.
So backed by these Lithuanian and Polish nobles and some Jesuits too, and with a newly gathered army of Cossacks and adventurers, this false Dmitri invaded Russia in October 1604. And he had some initial victories. He did all right at first. He attracted followers, especially in southern Russia, and he won some towns in that region in which the townspeople overthrew their governors in favor of him. And most of his supporters were Cossacks, townspeople, peasants, and bondsmen. In general, though, false Dmitri was defeated militarily until Tsar Boris suddenly dies in April of 1605. Then the government army shifted its support to Dmitri.
It's a game changer.
It was. They didn't want to swear allegiance to Tsar Boris's son, Fyodor. So after the army has switched allegiances, then there's a popular uprising against the Godunovs that leads the boyars to also think, hey, we want to switch over too. So they murder Boris's son and his wife, and false Dmitri arrives triumphantly in Moscow in June 1605 and is proclaimed Tsar with all the support of all sections of Russian society.
So he made it. I mean, I know we already told you he would in the introduction, but I still feel like you sort of don't see that coming. He's a pretender who makes it happen. So Tsar Dmitri is on the throne, but we still have no idea who this guy really is. Tsar Boris had accused him of being one Grigory Otrepiev, who was a member of the gentry who was linked to the house of the Romanovs and later became a monk in what was pretty much the most prestigious monastery in Moscow at the time. But Boris had accused Otrepiev of being a renegade type of monk who dabbled in things like sorcery and was in league with Satan, never a good thing for a monk.
No, that's about the worst thing that you can do.
And other accounts, though, sort of painted a different picture. They had him standing in good standing at the monastery, and he rose in the ranks remarkably quickly there and just sort of had a good reputation.
So what's interesting is that many historians also think that false Dmitri was Otrepiev, and this is probably the most prevalent theory that's out there right now, but some people think that there are some critics of this theory, I should say, think that there are some timing issues with this. That's one criticism that they have that throw it into question. For example, the monk might have actually been too old to pass for Dmitri. We don't actually have any birth records of him. So although people say that they were around the same age, we don't actually know that that's true. So there are some flaws in this theory. And according to a piece by Chester Dunning in the Slavic Review, one thing that many scholars agree on is that whoever false Dmitri really was, he must have been raised from childhood to believe that he was really Dmitri because he played the role so convincingly. So I find that really interesting because you think about pretenders and, I don't know, I think I often assume that it's just like a decision they make and then the next year they're pretending to be this person.
Political decision or a decision of ambition almost.
Right, but this might have been more of a long-term plan.
It's the ambition of somebody else, presumably, some older person who's grooming this young man or young boy even to eventually take a place. It reminded me again of the Lambert Simnel episode.
Exactly. Although what's interesting in Dmitri's case is that there have been a small number of researchers over the years who have pursued the possibility that Tsarevich Dmitri really did survive as a young child and that maybe this was the real Dmitri.
False Dmitri was the real Dmitri.
Yeah. I mean, there were some things that they point to, like irregularities with the child's burial. They waited for a long time to bury him. So maybe the bodies were swapped or something like that. So who knows?
That was a good one.
But in general, most people believe that he was, in fact, an imposter. But he didn't act like one when he got on the throne.
Well, and that would also explain being raised from a very young age to truly believe that he was the Tsarevich. But although some consider him to be the puppet of Polish nobles who supported him, several sources really paint false Dmitri as a, quote, extremely intelligent and resourceful leader, or a well-educated for a Russian czar, or well-versed in statecraft, advanced in his thinking and reform-minded, and even possessing a, quote, lively, even passionate temperament. So sounded like a lot of people were pretty pleased with what they got, even if the circumstances behind this young man coming to the throne were unusual, to say the least. Seemed like he did a pretty good job once he was there.
Or at least he doesn't seem like a total puppet.
A decent job.
Richard Helly even described Dmitri as, quote, one of the few really enlightened rulers Russia has ever had. And Dunning notes that some scholars have seen Dmitri as a forerunner to Peter the Great. Some of the things that Tsar Dmitri accomplished, in case you're interested, he lowered the tax burden and labor demands of the time. He also made plans for promoting education and science in Russia, and he worked to promote the effectiveness of the Russian army.
Unfortunately, though, or at least unfortunately for false Dmitri, he didn't have that much time to accomplish all of these things. Having a mind of his own really turned out to be his detriment, and he angered a lot of people, especially a lot of these nobles who weren't too into it in the first place. You know what I'm saying? So one of the things he did that really angered a lot of people was that early conversion to Catholicism. He also married the daughter of a Polish Catholic nobleman named Marina, which really even further strengthened that connection.
But he also did some other things that would have maybe upset the boyars of the time. He disrupted a lot of cultural norms, for example. He dressed and acted in informal or Western ways. He didn't attend church services for many hours each day. He did attend church services and go to functions and things like that, but he didn't do it maybe for as long, or he wasn't as involved as people hoped that he would be. He also didn't rest after the midday meal, which was customary, and he also didn't hide his disdain for the low level of education among boyars. So maybe that's why, after just a year as czar, false Dmitri falls victim to a boyar plot on May 17th, 1606. And after Dmitri's murder, the boyars put Vasily Shuisky, a man from an old boyar family, on the throne.
One of their own.
One of their own, exactly. And this marked the beginning of a period of political crisis known in Russia as the Time of Troubles.
So, we've told you in the beginning there were going to be a few of these false Dmitris. So now with this false Dmitri the first out of the way, opens the door for some new imposters to come in. Almost immediately after the nobles pulled off this plot, murdering Dmitri the Tsar, rumors started circulating that Dmitri had yet again escaped death. Maybe these rumors were started by his wife, maybe some other supporter, and it took a while for anything to come of that, but eventually the second false Dmitri did show up in July 1607. He bore no physical resemblance to the first false Dmitri. He actually gained a following, though. That didn't really seem to matter. He gained enough of a following, including Cossacks and Poles and Lithuanians and rebels, to cause the new czar some real trouble. And it's It gets even weirder than that, though, when you consider how far the support of this second false Dmitry went.
He did gain a lot of support. He gained control of southern Russia and set up headquarters at the village of Tushino, and that's why he's sometimes known as the Thief of Tushino. But the really crazy part here, to me at least, is that Marina, false Dmitry the first wife, recognizes the second false Dmitry as her husband, which gives him credibility. I mean, people think, obviously, if this woman says this is her husband,
wife
it must be true. Right. So they stayed together. They had a son eventually who they named Ivan. And false Dmitry II was eventually killed by one of his own followers in 1610. No one to this day really knows who he was. He may have been a priest's son or maybe a baptized Jew called Bogdanko.
So with false Dmitry II out of the way, we have an opening for false Dmitry III. And on March 1611, a third false Dmitry does show up in northwest Russia this time. But I guess it was an old story by this point. He really didn't gain quite as much of a following. And historians identify him as a former deacon. He did gain the alliance of, or the allegiance at least, of some Cossacks in a couple of towns. But he was also murdered by his own supporters May 1612. So that's the end of that immediate line of Dmitry's, but there were others that followed, not necessarily more Dmitry's, but other pretenders to the throne. It was a pretty wild time.
There were many pretenders, apparently, during the 17th century in Russia, and there are several explanations for that out there. For example, Perry suggests that monarchism was the only political ideology that existed in early modern Russia. So leaders of rebellions or social movements or what have you, they were called the true czar, and their enemies were considered traitors, and that's kind of how they set up that dichotomy. Wouldn't work today, I don't think.
No, not at all. I mean, I think the widespread use of photography would have put a pretty fast end to this sort of thing.
But yeah, and DNA paternity testing.
Yeah, you're not Dmitry. But I mean, I do think that's interesting that the only avenue open for them was forging some kind of legitimacy, saying that you are somehow related to the royal family in order to get a new political ideology or a new regime out there or overthrow somebody you don't like. It's a strange way of going about things.
Yeah. I think comparing it to today, though, I think that's why we're so interested in this phenomenon, is because it's just something we can't fathom. It seems so outrageous.
How could something like this happen?
Right.
So we do love a good pretender story, and I know a lot of people have been suggesting Bonnie Prince Charlie lately, and he has seriously been on my list of podcast topics for, I think, since I started. And History Today did an article on him recently, so he's still up there. But if you have any other pretender suggestions too, they are so much fun to talk about. You can email them to us at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. We're also on Twitter at Mist in History, and we're on Facebook. You can leave us a comment in any of those ways.
And if you want to learn a little bit more about how royalty and royal families work, we do have an article called How Royalty Works on our website. You can look it up by visiting our homepage at www.howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh,
Yeah. I love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.